I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, Emergency Edition, Friday, July 13th, Friday the 13th, 2018. It was a normal Friday morning until Rod Rosenstein called a 11:45 press conference, and most people didn't think it was going to reflect a Mueller indictment, since the president is off abroad meeting with Vladimir Putin. But it turned out that that was exactly what it was, and it's quite a doozy. 12 Russian military officers indicted for the DNC, DCCC, and Clinton campaign hacks and the distribution of the emails purloined in those attacks. There are none of them names you've ever heard before, but it is a major step for the Mueller investigation and the Russian electoral interference investigation. And we have the gang here to talk about it. Susan Hennessy, Matt Tate, David Criss, Paul Rosenzweig. Welcome, everybody. Paul, get us started. What was your reaction to the indictment?
Well, other than shock and awe, I'll give you five quick and important takeaways from my perspective. First, Putin has been telling everybody, including the president, that Russia had nothing to do with it. If any of the facts in this indictment are true, Putin's a liar, a public liar, and there's absolutely nothing more to be said about it. Second, none of these Russian officers are ever going to see the inside of an American court. So the purpose of this indictment is not the traditional one of putting bad guys in jail. Rather, it's an indictment that informs the American people about the processes by which the Russian government interfered in the 2016 election. It is, in effect, a public report rather than an indictment, simply because of that fact. Third, the forensic detail in this indictment is stunning. I'll let Matt talk to a great deal more of it, but you look at this indictment and you cannot have any doubt at all that the facts alleged lead to the conclusions that they've drawn, that the Russians deliberately and purposely made efforts to and succeeded in getting inside the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and the Hillary campaign. Fourth, it is beyond a doubt now that WikiLeaks is at best a pawn of Russian intelligence and at worst a part of the coordinated Russian operation. They took information from Guccifer II, they solicited it, and anybody who seriously treats them as a journalism outlet after this is just beyond credulousness. And final point, and probably the most important point, is we're getting closer and closer to the Trump campaign. After reading this indictment, Roger Stone has to be looking over his shoulder. He's not named, but it is clear as a bell that it is he who was speaking to Guccifer II, a now known to us to be a Russian front. And he was also, at the same time as the indictment alleges, in regular contact with senior members of the Trump presidential campaign. The indictment squarely puts into question Stone's actions, and his conduct is going to be, I think, the next shoe that drops. Those are my five quick takeaways.
Brilliant. David Criss, one of the things that Rod Rosenstein said today was that the independent counsel or the special counsel's office was passing this off to the National Security Division, having brought this indictment. I assume that was because they have no custody over any of the people and no plausible means of getting it. You used to run the National Security Division. What do you make of this indictment and the inheriting of it by your on the day it comes out by your former shop?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Paul said. Let me try to sort of make a couple of non-overlapping points. First is, this was a major missing piece of Mueller's mosaic of charges. Previously, we'd seen indictments involving propaganda, both overt and covert, the offering and exchange of things of value to the campaign and others, and of course a good deal of concealment and lying, which you typically get in these kinds of investigations. But until now, we hadn't seen any charges related to the hacking, doxing of the DNC, which obviously was a major part of the Russian effort. So I think this sort of rounds out, you might say, the basic sketch of the Russian election interference. It is a factually rich and therefore compelling narrative. It serves the same function for the hacking elements of the Russian program that I think the Internet Research Agency served, indictment served for the propaganda element. Takes the fairly narrow language of the 2017 intelligence community assessment and translates it into a very compelling narrative that ordinary Americans might have a better chance of understanding because it has a compelling narrative arc and a lot of juicy detail. I think, second, going forward, you know, Mueller is following what I think of as standard procedure in a case like this, which is, of course, no surprise given who he is. You typically start with the outer ring, the low-hanging fruit, the most sort of obvious and readily provable elements that you can, and then you work your way in towards the bullseye. And so I agree with Paul that those at the center ought to be concerned that next steps may involve the walls starting to close in. I think Mueller has more or less rounded out the basic elements here, and he's going to start looking in. The handoff to NSD, I think, probably reflects not only the fact that this indictment may be pending for quite some time, given that these officers in the GRU may be well advised not to travel abroad, but I think also a couple of other factors that are still going to pose some challenges for this case. The first is the First Amendment status of WikiLeaks. I had thought that was one of the reasons this indictment was taking time, was that they were working out the institutional posture of the Department of Justice with respect to publishing entities like WikiLeaks. Looks like this indictment deferred that decision and described but did not name or charge WikiLeaks, but it's still possible that some kind of additional work will arise there if the department decides that it can and should bring charges in that space. This indictment certainly gives you a roadmap for that. And then second, of course, there's gonna be complex source and method challenges. I'm sure there were challenges in drawing up the indictment, and any further work, including but not limited to any prosecution on this indictment, would require a good deal of careful expertise in the Classified Information Procedures Act and various other techniques. I think NSD is among the very best that the government has for navigating those complex issues. So it's a sensible handoff in my view.
Susan, when you look at the kind of closing of the ring quality of this indictment, which David just referred to and Paul referred to earlier, you know, Rosenstein was very careful to say, we don't make any allegations about any Americans that anybody knowingly participated, and the White House pounced on that. How reassured do you think anybody should be in the, you know, there's no collusion allegation here department?
So I would be incredibly nervous if I was President Trump or his inner circle right now. I do think that this is a really, really significant development for a couple of reasons. One is that degree of really meticulous detail that they're laying out. You know, keep in mind, this is the kind of evidence that was underlying that intelligence community assessment that Trump has been ignoring over and over and over again over the past 2 years, right? This is the quality, the quantity, the certainty of that evidence. And so I do think that this raises it's going to limit Trump's space to deny this stuff moving forward. I also think it's worth zooming out and in the broader context of all the various threads that the Mueller investigation is pursuing. This is the investigation that Jim Comey was fired over. And I do think that that raises significant questions as we get closer and closer to the bullseye about why exactly was Trump so anxious to relieve to obstruct this investigation or relieve pressure? You know, what was the source of the anxiety there? I agree that the next set of indictments, and again, we should be careful, it's uncharged conduct and we don't actually know, is likely to be Americans. I actually think that one of the most significant factual developments in this indictment is we had previously assumed that essentially the hacking campaign had concluded prior to the release, and maybe even several, like many months prior to the release. And so whenever we were thinking about whether or not there was, for example, possible conspiracy liability under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, we were approaching that analysis kind of assuming that, well, the hacking occurs and then the release is this separate act, and that's a really complex legal analysis. What this document, what this indictment says is, no, there's an ongoing conspiracy. It's happening throughout the summer of 2016. It's happening as these documents are being released. It's happening as there are communications between charged conspirators in this document, American citizens, including American citizens close to the Trump campaign, the Trump organization. And so I think that, and those communications are on the subject of the conspiracy, right? The hacking and dissemination of emails. And so, you know, look, I don't know that we're all the way to sort of the federal aiding and abetting statutes here, but we're getting a lot closer than we were 10 hours ago.
All right. So I have here, in a kind of Marshall McLuhan kind of moment, I happen to have here somebody who Guccifer 2 follows on Twitter, which is to say Matt Tate. And Matt, there's only two people, technical specialists, whom Guccifer 2 follows on Twitter. Who are they?
There's me, and there's also Codelancer, who's the technical guy for Kaspersky. So it's not many. It's mostly journalists that he follows.
So tell us the story of how you and Guccifer 2 came to be Twitter buddies.
Okay, so very shortly after the Washington Post came out with their original post saying that CrowdStrike had gone into the DNC and had discovered that the Russian government had hacked all of their servers. I was quite close, quite early coming out and saying that's quite unusual to say that you found multiple Russian government groups on the same network. That sounded a little bit unusual. But the next day when they started publishing lots of these documents, I started having a look into them, because suddenly it started looking much more unusual and starting pulling apart lots of their propaganda, having a look at a lot of their documents and sort of trying to find out whether or not any forgeries had been put in there. And a consequence of some of the work that I did then was that you started seeing over the next few days they were putting out new documents to discredit some of that earlier analysis. When they set up their Twitter account, one of the accounts that they followed was mine.
When you read this document, you read it with a very different set of eyes than the rest of us do. So for those of you who don't know this, and I say this as an amateur lawyer myself, Matt is an exceptional amateur lawyer. But that is his second qualification. Primarily, you're a technical guy. And so when you read an indictment like this, the whole first half of which is describing what the Russians were doing and is also reflecting U.S. technical capabilities to find out what the Russians are doing, you are figuring out you are seeing all kinds of things that the rest of us don't see. So what did you learn from this indictment? Not about Bob Mueller, not about the trajectory of the investigation, but about the hack and the Russian technical operation and the U.S. technical operation to discover the Russian technical operation.
Right. So there's an enormous amount of detail in this document, and there's a lot of really interesting things. I think that the first thing that's very important is, unlike the Internet Research Agency, which was this organization sort of loosely attached to the Russian government, this is quite explicitly the Russian Intelligence Service, GRU. We are now indicting military officers who are currently serving in the Russian military. And one of the things that's very interesting in this document is that it's quite clear that we're naming 12 specific individuals, where they sit within the organization. We can see that there's two different groups inside GRU that are responsible for this. There's Unit 26165, which are the group that actually did the hacking itself. We can see that there's two separate groups within that unit, one which was largely responsible for the spear phishing operations that they did. Spear phishing is how they broke into the DNC in the first place. It's also how, of course, they got John Podesta's emails. There's a second group in there as well, which was responsible for running malware operations inside the DNC. We can see who the specific individuals are within these groups that were doing this. And we also see a completely separate group, Unit 74455, which was physically located somewhere else, and that was responsible for the publishing of these documents. So we can see that there's a lot of really interesting detail about the organizational structures that are inside the Russian government that were responsible for this. And we can see the level of detail that the US government has. There was a lot of detail, of course, before that was public, technical details about, why it was already known that John Podesta had been hacked by GRU. We already knew that the DNC had been hacked by GRU. There's a lot of public evidence about that. But what this indictment does is it gives us a really sort of deep insight into additional layers of information that the US government has. They're able to tell what these specific operators inside the Russian government were doing. They could tell when they were doing. They could see what search terms they were looking for. They could say that it was this particular Russian officer who was at the keyboard when this was happening rather than that particular Russian officer. And that's a level of detail that really was not available in the public space before, and sort of details a really extensive counterintelligence campaign by the US government against this group, and really gives lie to the fact that the US government has enormous detail here.
And so just when you say counterintelligence, so some of our listeners will not pick up the nuance of that. I take that to mean that that you're suggesting this is not simply a retroactive investigation of a hack after it happened, but that we were probably in their systems in real time as they were doing this in the first place. Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, so my read of the indictment is there's a level of detail here that you can't get just from a forensic detail, looking at the DNC network, looking at the emails that were leaked. This looks like probably the NSA had access to this network either in real time or shortly afterwards, and was able to piece together at some enormous level of detail who it was that was doing what and where and for what reason within the organization itself, down to, in the indictment it has the US government is even aware of, like, the slang terms used by different GRU officers to refer to other buildings. Like, this is the US government, in order to have put this indictment together, needs to have had extremely targeted, very specific intelligence for these specific individuals, and that's a level of detail we didn't have before.
Okay, so again, playing my Woody Allen Marshall McLuhan role, I happen to have an NSA lawyer right here, and as Matt is describing this level of technical detail being blown by issuing this indictment, I am thinking that all over Fort Meade, there are people with their heads between their knees thinking, why on earth are we doing this? So Susan, talk us through, what are the circumstances in which the government, in weighing all its equities here, will say the interests of prosecuting 12 people who we're never going to get our hands on is actually worth blowing this kind of sources and methods information that you have to do to put a document like this together?
So the short answer is that we don't know, because without knowing the individual sources and methods, you don't know what value they might not have been as valuable moving forward as they were for sort of this point in time. That said, that any time that there's this level of detail and this level of declassification necessary, there is a relatively lengthy debate, sometimes argument, that goes on between Justice Department lawyers, NSA lawyers within other parts of the intelligence community. I do think that one thing that is striking here, and I sort of suspect is underlying the decision, is so first, these individuals are never going to be never going to see the inside of a courtroom, as Paul said, and that means that this is the only opportunity to tell this story. And so I think that there is an exceptional need to be as detailed as possible. You know, the other thing is that you're up against a president that has been denying this over and over and over again. And so Trump himself has actually staked sort of, he's put the credibility so at issue that whenever Mueller is going to come forward and take this kind of step and make this kind of indictment, I do think that there is a heightened need to want to prove its case, show its work to the American people. And so in some ways, I would suspect that it's Trump's own behavior, his own refusal to acknowledge and lend credibility to the intelligence community to help it be in a position where they say, we don't need to give you the sources and methods details, just take our word for it, that then essentially forces Mueller's hand in needing to give really, really highly detailed amounts of information. You know, that said, this is not hugely different from what we've seen in indictments related to Iran, indictments of the Chinese PLA hackers. And so I do think that there's also a sort of a broader shift in wanting to show the attribution capacity and capability as part of a long-term deterrence plan.
So, David, I'm interested in your view of this as somebody who has done a lot of work with NSA, but also represented the Justice Department's equities in some of these. You know, what are the factors where, you know, to what extent when you look at the equities here, is the president's denial and the kind of, you know, the degree of presidential, I mean, lying about the intelligence community going to be a significant factor that pushes an equities process toward greater disclosure of sensitive material in order to establish the truth?
Honestly, Ben, you know, in all my years on either or both sides of that kind of debate, I've never seen a situation just like this. So it is a little bit hard to map it to any prior precedent. I will say that I'm more, I think, with Susan than Matt as to whether folks at Fort Meade, though, are feeling nauseous or whatever about this. I think, you know, they, I'm sure, had a robust and flavorful discussion between and among them in the usual way, and have thought through the SEPA implications of this, Classified Information Procedures Act, and ways in which they can safeguard sources and methods. And I also think a considerable amount of this may have been able to have been obtained possibly after the fact through criminal authorities. I was struck by the amount of locational data. Matt mentioned, you know, building names and locations and addresses. And, you know, I wonder after Carpenter how they were getting location data on some of this stuff, but they could have been doing that using some criminal authorities. So I guess I'm just a little less concerned about the source and method issues here. But I honestly do not know how to calibrate, or how they did calibrate, if at all, the role of presidential denials. I am sure the Mueller team was pushing, and I am sure there were people in the intelligence community who were pushing back. And, you know, I don't know how that debate came out or how it was influenced by the president's statements.
And in just as a technical matter, I mean, I know that in a normal or even abnormal but sane administration, an equities process like this would be ultimately mediated by the attorney general. And I suppose to the extent that there's something really irreconcilable, by the NSC. How does it work when the attorney general is recused and when the president is daily attacking the deputy attorney general?
So in theory, you know, the conversation, as Susan well knows, begins at the working level. And then either side, if it's dissatisfied with the agreement that may be reached at the working level, can escalate on their side. And so that could go up through John Demers, currently the head of the National Security Division, and then it would top out in this case at Rod Rosenstein because Attorney General Sessions is not participating here. And correspondingly, it could go all the way through General Nakasone to, in theory, you know, Director Coates, the DNI, and thence to the NSC. The weird thing about it would be that ultimately, of course, if push really comes to shove on something like this, which very, very rarely happens, it would be decided in sort of normal cases by the president. The president, it would be fair to say, has not been terribly, terribly scrupulous about adhering to traditional conflict of interest principles with respect to an investigation in which he has been identified as a subject. I guess this one didn't come to him, or if it did, there must have been a really, you know, bang up indictment that got stifled due to source and method concerns. So, you know, it gets worked out and it gets escalated, but I presume this one, neither side would have wanted to take it to the White House for resolution for obvious reasons.
Paul, one thing I read when it struck me when I was reading this indictment today, and this is in your capacity as somebody who has some familiarity with special counsel investigations. I read this and I said, this doesn't read like a guy who's busy writing a report. This reads like a special prosecutor who's interested in bringing cases. And then I thought, well, maybe that's because the investigation is actually really quite bifurcated. There really is the Russian interference investigation, and then there's the obstruction investigation, and they're sufficiently bifurcated that you could be sort of in report mode on one of them and in real operational mode on the other. But I'm interested in your read. Have we all been snowed into thinking that Mueller is busily writing a report right now because that's what the president's lawyers have been putting out for a while, and they've been sort of assiduous about that and so then kind of convinced a lot of people in the press, and really what he's doing is he's prosecuting a bunch of people in connection with Russian interference and lying to the investigation and money laundering and all those things? Or is that the other side of the Mueller investigation, and you know, and one half is actually sitting there busily writing Star Report Part Two?
Well, at the risk of saying I told you so, back in March when the first reports came out that Mueller was writing an obstruction report, on one of these emergency podcasts, I expressed serious doubt about that, both because I thought it was premature in terms of the timing of the investigation and because I didn't think that Mueller was going to be writing reports like that for public consumption. And I still do not. His obligation under the regulations is to report to the attorney general, in this case, the acting attorney general. And I think that's what he's going to do when he's done. I continue to believe that Mr. Mueller is playing this game as straight as he knows how within the confines of the regulations and DOJ policy that are given to him. And that means that he's going to continue to bring indictments. And where he doesn't have indictments, he's not going to be giving us, reports recommending, impeachment charges against the president or anything like that. I don't think that that's what he sees as his remit. And so I do sort of think that everybody got a little bit snowed, not anybody on this call, of course, on this podcast, but some people got snowed, and it's mostly stuff and nonsense and wishful thinking from, back at the time. It was Ty Cobb and John Dowd, and now it's you don't see Emmett Flood saying that publicly anymore.
So none of us is a foreign policy person. At our core. On the other hand, it is a striking thing that this document comes out within a couple days of when the president is supposed to meet with, of all people, Vladimir Putin. And Rosenstein says at the press conference today that he briefed him that he was on the fact that he was going to do this. And he also said that it was important that the president know this information for his meeting with Putin, that he be fully abriefed of on threats to the United States. But I thought it was really interesting that they did not defer this action for a few days to avoid embarrassing, one might say humiliating, the president in an interaction with an adversary foreign leader. And I'm curious for all of your sense of is it proper for Mueller or Rosenstein to consider waiting a couple days, assuming everything's ready to go? Is the right answer that you just do it when it's ready to go, and if it embarrasses the president on the international stage, that's fine? Or is the right answer that there are prudential calculations that are legitimate to consider in these circumstances? And if so, what are the equities in those, given the relations between Putin and Trump? Susan, get us started on this.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to keep in mind is this wouldn't humiliate a normal president, right? So this is only uncomfortable for Donald Trump because he routinely denies sort of the obvious facts. And so ordinarily, whenever we're thinking through the equities, this might actually be a gift to a president who was about to meet with Vladimir Putin in terms of really, really showing their hand, not only on the degree of what's known, but the degree of how much they're willing to make their case to the public. I think the other thing that's interesting is, you know, it's not the timing of the indictment, it is the timing of the announcement. So to the extent that Rod Rosenstein said, you know, I think that the president needed to know this information in order to make decisions, you know, ... meeting with Vladimir Putin. But in releasing this, I think what is happening is he's telling the American people, right? And so that's a different thing. It's not just that he wants the president to be informed. If so, he might have informed the president and then waited a few days to avoid this particular the optics. Plus, you know, Rod Rosenstein has gone out of his way to not unnecessarily anger the president. He himself is in a little bit of a precarious situation. But I do think that part of the calculus here, and I think it's more likely to be Rosenstein's calculus than Robert Mueller's calculus, was making the case in public and potentially insisting that the president be confronted and informed by public facts, which is rather different for this president than being informed by facts that are known only to him and within the U.S. government.
What do you think, David, if you were in Mueller's shoes, Paul as well, if you guys were in Mueller's shoes, and you knew that the president was meeting with Putin on Monday, is Friday a good day to hand up this indictment?
Certainly quite a coincidence, isn't it? Rod Rosenstein this morning did say that it was just a product of charges being ready and I guess the grand jury being available. I do think there's a couple of reasons why this indictment took a little longer than the Internet Research Agency indictment. We've talked about both of them, the first being potential First Amendment issues around WikiLeaks, which I think they just deferred ultimately. I guess they couldn't get to a decision fast enough. And the second being the source and method issues that Matt talked about. But why this particular Friday? You know, it's quite a coincidence. I don't know what more to say on that. In terms of consultations with the White House, in case anybody's thinking about that, it is not unusual in these kinds of cases to do a no foreign policy objection on both, at least on the timing of an indictment. That is, DOJ would talk to state in certain situations like this. And informing the president before he goes to meet with Putin in this case doesn't strike me as untoward or outside the norm. But I have no briefs to file on the particular timing of the indictment. I don't know how it happened and can't really explain it from the outside.
On the topic of the timing, it is, as David says, quite odd, but I'm not sure that there's a winner decision here. It looks just as bad a week from now after the meeting on Monday, in which presumably Trump sings Putin's praises, and then the release of the indictment looks like his own Department of Justice, gaslighting him after the fact. So I don't think that the department has a winning time frame here. And so I do think it is a product of the fact that it's ready now, and perhaps even a little bit of a fear that having disclosed it to the White House, it would leak before it happened. And so they want to get it done before in a formal way rather than in some leak from a White House that is notoriously civ-like in its behavior.
So just to be clear, Paul, you're agreeing with Susan that the fundamental problem here is the president's posture, which creates a no-win situation for DOJ, not the way DOJ handled it.
I think that's right. And more to the point, but I would go even further. And I would say if you had some information like this, even if it was a normal president, you'd have a tough time getting the right time to make. There's no good time for this bad news.
It's worth also just mentioning something that echoes the point Susan made earlier, which is that we have already had a published official statement of the U.S. intelligence community since January 2017 that ascribes all of this conduct to the GRU and Guccifer II, including the hacking of Podesta's emails and the DNC. So although it's true that, you know, the president and others have denied that, the U.S. government's official position has been, at least at the agency level, has been on the record for, you know, well over a year now. So in that sense, it's incremental.
Matt, there's another timing coincidence with respect to the issuance of this indictment, which is that it's one day after the Pete Strzok marathon abuse testimony situation on the Hill. We actually know that Mueller didn't do this as a response to that because Rosenstein briefed the president on it days ago. But it couldn't have been better timed if it was meant as a response to what the Hill did yesterday. You watched, as you told me earlier, all of Strzok's testimony, all 10 hours. Just at a gut level, how does reading this document today after watching that event yesterday talk about that contrast?
Well, it's certainly a big contrast. And one of the things to bear in mind, of course, is that Peter Strzok knows all of the information in this document. You know, he used to be the deputy assistant director and head of the counter intelligence division at FBI. He will have known a significant amount of...
Although notably, he's been off the case for over a year. So it is interesting to think how much of this was developed within the past year, and how much have they known all along?
That's true, and he was also on Mueller's team as well. He will have known a lot of this type of information, and really, that's not what the conversation yesterday was about in Congress. So when it comes to the timing itself, the proximate why it was on Friday, of course, is that's the day when the grand jury meets for the Mueller investigation. Why this happened now, I think, you know, Paul's right. This is, you know, it takes some time to do these indictments. You know, they're not doing things, you know, in response to these events. I think Mueller would be very... he would be crazy to be thinking about the foreign policy implications of these things and making his timing based on that. If you look at what's happened with Comey with respect to the Inspector General report, if you look at what happened with Peter Strzok with respect to being called up in front of Congress, if there's any suggestion at all, if there's any document, any text message anywhere that says that Mueller was thinking about how this affects Donald Trump's foreign policy, how this affects him politically, how it affects election timelines, they're going to get torn apart. So I think that they'll have taken a very conscious decision that they're just going to play it completely straight. They're going to do it as it comes. They're not going to take any of this into account, because the consequence of them taking it into account, even if they're taking it into account in the president's favor, it will get construed badly for them at some point later. And they're going to need their powder to be dry when that happens.
So while we're on the topic of timing coincidences, I do sort of have a question for this group, and maybe Ben, you know, since you've been asking the questions, you know, I'll ask it to you first. But, you know, there are sort of little tidbits in this indictment that a more conspiratorial-minded person might think were included for a reason. I think most significantly that on July 27th, the conspirators attempted after hours to spearfish for the first time email accounts at a domain hosted by Hillary Clinton's personal office. So earlier in that day, this is whenever Donald Trump makes his now quite famous statement, Russia, if you're listening, it would be great to have those 30,000 emails. Is this included for a reason to send some kind of message? Is this something that it's crazy to say that there's a link between these two things? Like, why is this level of detail, not just the dates, but that it's the first time and what they target? Do you think there's anything to read into it?
Well, there's definitely something to read into it. The question is whether when you read that into it, you will be doing it rightly or wrongly, right? Look, I think we will not know the answer to that until there is or is not a subsequent action that either puts meat on the bones or doesn't by the lack of its existence. And, you know, either at some point we're going to get a stateside indictment of U.S. persons for their interactions with both the IRA conspiracy to deprive the United States of regulatory jurisdiction over a variety of things, or this CFAA conspiracy indictment and identity theft indictment, hacking indictment. In which case we will presumably learn when those indictments are brought and those cases are prosecuted. And by the way, those cases will involve custody over the individuals, so they'll actually be litigated. We will learn at that point whether the government's position is really that this is a Russian side thing, or whether that this is an interactive process in which what's going on this side of the Atlantic really matters. Until then, I think we don't know, but I certainly noticed that. There are a lot of dates in there that are worth noticing. A lot of activity takes place right in the period after the Trump Tower meeting as well. And, you know, I think, you know, a reasonable person reading this indictment along with a bunch of news stories about what's going on in June and July and April and May of 2016, you don't have to be the kind of person who sees connections between all sorts of unconnected things to scratch your head and say, hey, how much are people on this side of the Atlantic aware of or in interaction with what's going on that side of the Atlantic? And I just think we have to keep falling back on what is a kind of working principle of life these days, which is Bob Mueller knows more than we do. And, you know, he will at some point choose to let us know whether that inclusion of that particular date and the words the first time is coincidental or not. I don't know. Does anybody think it's more or less suggestive than that?
So my view is that you should be quite careful about drawing too many conclusions from the times, just because when you actually plot out how much was going on in June and July in 2016, it's quite easy to forget, you know, this far after the event, but quite how crowded that time was in terms of the sheer number of things just happening. You know, this was when there was large numbers of primaries taking place. All of the candidates were giving, you know, speeches at rallies constantly. You have the GRU setting up large numbers of websites, vast numbers of spear phishing attempts. You know, there's 300 members of Clinton and her campaign were targeted. Once you start putting this number of events into that shorter time space, there's lots of things happening very close to each other, which are actually coincidences. And so I would caution people against drawing too many inferences based on events happening close together at that time.
The two of you who've drawn up indictments in your lifetimes, which is not true of anybody in this room, do the words "for the first time" show up in a document like this by accident? What do you think, David?
Oh, I don't know. I sort of agree with Matt. I mean, they may or may not have been there on purpose as a little Easter egg for the intelligentsia to ferret out and cackle in delight. That may or may not mean something more substantive, but I think I can't tell, you know, whether they are laying the groundwork for an express allegation of connection, either direct or indirect. I just can't tell.
Paul, are you willing to go out on a limb and say this is there for a reason, damn it?
Yes.
Go for it. Make the case.
No tinfoil. But having written enough of these indictments, every word is there for a reason. I don't know for sure what this reason is, but the fact that it was the first time is of some significance to Mueller. If it wasn't, he wouldn't put it in, because every fact you put in is a fact that ultimately you have to prove at trial. Assuming there's a trial, which there won't be in this case, but you don't put in needless facts unless they are provable and relevant. So I tend to think that it was more than an Easter egg for the intelligentsia. In fact, given the way that the entire press corps has blown up noting this coincidence, the Mueller team is not stupid. They had to have known that that is exactly the reaction they were going to get. And so they only bought that for a reason. What that reason is, I don't know. But I suspect there's some connective tissue here that they think they can prove on.
All right. So we need to head toward wrapping up here, but I want to get people's sense of what may be coming next. We are heading into, I think I'm confident that we all agree on this, but I think we're heading into the period in which, if there isn't action before that, after the Comey experience in 2016, there is zero chance that Bob Mueller will take major in public investigative steps after a certain date, before the midterms. Do we all agree about that? Oh, Matt says no. Do the rest of us all agree on that?
I think it's unlikely we see anything after September 1st.
David, Paul, what is the drop-dead date after which we have a dead zone to September, till November, before I let Matt tell me why we're all wrong?
I agree with Susan. Labor Day is the traditional start of the election campaign season and is typically, as a matter of good governance, the drop-dead date for indictments of political nature.
Sounds reasonable enough. There isn't a bright line rule in the U.S. Attorney's Manual on the timing. So, you know, I'd be interested in Matt's theory as to why they're going to roll right over that.
Yeah, so what? Why are they going to roll right over that, Matt?
So I don't think they'll do it deliberately, but I think they're going to be really careful about ever being in a situation where they can be accused of taking a decision based on when an election is going to take place. I think if there was a single email inside the Mueller investigation saying we're not going to do this because of the election or we're going to do that because of the election, I think that would be a disaster for them. And so I think that they're going to take a conscious decision to not take some of these things into account.
Why wouldn't they just handle that by saying the IG just excoriated Jim Comey for violating standard DOJ practice, which the IG described as blah, blah, blah. We are going to follow the consensus practice as described by his divinity, Michael Horowitz.
I think if they can point to a document inside the DOJ and say that there's a DOJ regulation, they'll say we are going to be bound by that. But I don't think if it's just a norm, I don't think they're going to abide by it. They're just going to say, if we can point to a regulation that says that after this date, we're not going to, then we're not going to. And otherwise, we can't take it into account.
Like, they might also try and square the circle by saying that an indictment of the president's inner circle or an overtly political figure, that would have a bearing on the campaign, but other indictments, other investigative steps related to Roger Stone, related to Paul Manafort, that actually is not things that are related to or should be influencing in the election. And if it does so, then so be it. But that's tangential. I think there is a possibility that they sort of draw a circle around the elements of this case in which they're going to pause, and then the rest allowed to sort of proceed more in the fashion Matt's describing.
Okay, so for those of you who believe that there is a dead zone between September 1 and November, whatever election day is this year, My question is, what are you expecting between now and September 1? And for Matt, wave the dead zone principle. And if you want it to bleed a little closer to the election, that's fine. Susan, get us started.
So I don't know if it's before or after the election, but I do think that the next thing we're going to see is an indictment of Americans involved in this hacking operation to the extent that they exist. And I think this indictment suggests that there's a reasonable probability that they do. I think if you look at sort of the steps and then the tightening noose here, first, the first indictment that occurs in February, Mueller's kind of laying out, one, there's a broad conspiracy to interfere in the election. Two, there's a disinformation campaign. It's all based overseas, right? So he sort of establishes that predicate. This set of indictment now is talking about more specific crimes within the United States, these computer fraud and abuse allegations, all against non-US citizens. I think that the next logical step is, okay, now that we've established that this hacking conspiracy occurred, now we're going to look at who are the Americans that may have been involved.
And where do you think the obstruction side fits into that? Is there a concurrent report, or is that just going to die out, or are there indictments that you think are likely in that department?
I think that's harder to predict, and I do think that from sort of the tea leaves that we can read from the outside, it does appear as though the Mueller team is treating that element, the obstruction investigation inquiry, really as quite distinct from sort of the Russian interference inquiry. I honestly continue to believe that Mueller is not going to wrap up the obstruction investigation until he interviews the president. I know that that's a controversial view at this point, but I just don't buy that he's going to be willing to close the book on it. So I think ultimately sort of the timing of the obstruction investigation or the obstruction report or however that ultimately concludes is going to vary or depend a great deal on whether or not Trump finally decides to sit down with Mueller.
Matt, what are you expecting?
So I think that's right. I think that what we've seen so far is with the Internet Research Agency, this was non-government employees overseas. With this particular one, we see government employees overseas. I think what we're likely to see next is Americans that are not government employees and not part of the Trump circle in the United States. And then we're going to start seeing that's going to close in. It might take a long time. Like you're talking about before the election, some of this could still be years off. This is a very big investigation. It could take a long time. I think one of the big wild cards is what's going to happen with Manafort. We don't know whether or not he's going to start cooperating with the Mueller team and what it's going to mean in the event that he does. And one of the other things, of course, is that we've seen a big narrative build through indictments. They're not going to be able to do that with Donald Trump himself. If Donald Trump has anything that for a normal citizen would be criminal, they're not going to be able to indict the president. So there's all sorts of interesting questions as to whether they would write a report in lieu of an indictment in his particular case. But I still think we're a very long way off from any of this concluding, and we're really just reading tea leaves at this point.
Paul, what is your forward-looking expectation within the September 1 time horizon?
If they push, Roger Stone will be indicted. He's clearly the next subject of interest for the Mueller team. Meanwhile, House Republicans will try and impeach Rod Rosenstein. And President Trump will talk about firing Mr. Mueller.
So we can't get David's prediction because he's turned into a puff of smoke. So let's finish up. Final thoughts, Paul. Give us one or two things to leave with.
Well, two final thoughts that are just kind of orthogonal to what we've been talking about. The first is that buried in this indictment was the revelation that a candidate for the U.S. Congress reached out to Guccifer 2.0 for adverse information about his opponent. Given the timing of this. It was clearly after the primary season had closed. And the fact that Guccifer had Democratic information, we can infer that this was a Republican candidate. Who I don't know yet, but we'll find out. That's a fun thing to tease out. And the second thing, which is actually my most saddening takeaway, is that as Susan pointed out earlier, almost all of the information that's in this indictment was probably available in one form or another at the time through the intelligence community. And what this reminds us is that the Obama administration actually sought bipartisan support for calling out the Russians for their interference. And it was the Republicans in Congress, in particular Mitch McConnell, who refused to participate. We now have a sense of the type of information that McConnell closed his eyes to. And if that's really the case, then I can think of nothing more damning than to say that Mitch McConnell is beyond despair, unspeakable, traitor to his loyalty to America over his party. And not treasonous, but a traitor to his country in that sense.
Susan, final thoughts.
So I am paying especially close attention to the comments of the SSCI Vice Chairman Mark Warner, who indicated that most of this information was news to them. This is a group that, you know, we a lot of times talk about how Robert Mueller isn't going to save us. I do think that that's a pretty good indication that it's Mueller or nothing. And expecting the congressional committees to come up with serious new information is probably not realistic. And so however this ends, Mueller is going to have the final say.
Matt, final thoughts.
Yeah, I think this is going to be interesting to see how Russia responds to this, because clearly these people are not going to be going to jail. That's not the result of this document. It's going to be interesting to see how Donald Trump in particular responds to this and how the Russian government responds, whether or not they decide to start indicting people from NSA, for instance. You know, these are Russian government employees. I think it's also... You know, we're going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to wait and see how this sort of plays out, and whether or not the next indictments are going to come, and what those are going to look like. I think it's easy to speculate now as to what that might look like, but I think we just have to wait and see.
I will just say, for my own part, my final thought is: don't forget the obstruction side when the president's lawyers, and granted they are a hugely biased source, released the supposed list of subjects that Mueller wanted to talk to the president about. Some of it was about this, but a huge amount of it was about the subject of his interactions with law enforcement, and there clearly is a major investigation. Separate maybe from this, but related to into the president's interactions with the law enforcement and intelligence apparatus. And someday we are going to hear from that group of people in one way or another. And I'm cognizant of Paul's point, but I also think that the total amount we're going to hear is likely not to be zero. With that, this has been a special edition on an emergency basis of the Lawfare podcast, which is today, as all days, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks to everybody on the Lawfare team who put in a long day today, which is not quite over for us. Thanks to Paul and David for joining us. To Matt for being our audio engineer today, and to Matt and Michaela for editing. You need to do your part to tweet about the Lawfare podcast. Our special editions are a great time to do this. Tweet it. Tell people at dinner parties that they need to listen to the special edition of the Lawfare podcast. They need to subscribe to the Lawfare podcast. You know, all those people who are annoying because they talk about their favorite podcasts all the time when you don't listen to them, you know those people. I want you to be one of them. I want you to impose this on other people. And I want you to go to the iTunes, the Stitcher, the whatever podcast distribution service you use, I want you to go to their rating system and I want you to leave us a little review and I want you to leave us a rating and I know what it's going to be. And I want you to just do that and stop not doing it. And I want you to share us on Facebook. So those are my asks of you. Also, you should go to the Support Lawfare page and give a contribution to Lawfare. You know you should do that. With that, thanks for listening.